been waiting for this day for 2 months, Harold. I'm really excited when you told me that you would speak this morning. So let's get Harold right up here and hear what he has to say for us. This is Harold Christopher. He and his wife currently live down in Arkansas. They've got a bunch of grandchildren. How many children?
Five.
That's what I thought. Five children and grandchildren. And we're awfully glad that you guys made the trip.
Thank you.
I need to address Wayne here just a minute. We were having a conversation outside, and the name came up, Howard Freeman. Okay, Howard Freeman from Lusk, Wyoming. Y'all sometime remember him, probably. I was working in a little hospital, and so couldn't make the trip, so Sharon, my wife, and I think two children, probably Wendy, this had been maybe 82, and it was in New Mexico, and it was a church camp put on by maybe Sheldon Emery. That kind of maybe was kind of what I'm thinking. Anyhow, Howard Freeman, any of you remember him? Okay, kind of looked like a little chipmunk almost a little bit. That's kind of the way he was an engineer, I think. But he had turned somewhat of a little bit rogue from the system at that point. And I think he had one time said he'd sit down and talk with the local judge, and the judge thought he was one of the most dangerous men in the county around Lusk. And he was just a little, it was his thought processes. And Sharon came home, and as I say, we had two little kids at this point, and I'm working in the hospital, and busy. And Sharon said, there's somebody talking about homeschooling. Well, maybe we ought to be educating our kids at home. I said, Sharon, I'd been a teacher. I taught for a year, had a degree in secondary education, and I'd taught some high school. And I said, well, Sharon, that's why they pay school people, school teachers for stuff like that. Well, just a little bit of a twist every once in a while. Finally, Wendy was born in 77. And she's never been in a public school.
Wow.
She now has seven children, and they've never been in the public school.
Hallelujah. And
then all the children followed along at that point. So we've learned a lot in the ensuing years, and made a bunch of mistakes. I'm gonna start this morning have we opened with prayer here? Have we already done that?
Yeah. Well, all we did was bless the food.
Okay, let's just
pray with here.
Heavenly Father, we ask that you'd be with us this day. Help us to seek to be useful in thy kingdom. We ask for forgiveness of our sins. Help us to honor you in the way you'd want us to honor you. In Christ's name we pray, and for his sake, amen. The second thing I was going to mention was that Sharon, we were recently at a funeral of Sharon's brother, and he had passed 77, lived a full life, and his son-in-law, one of his son-in-laws, who we've met only two or three times. They live out in California, and you know, fairly prestigious building business. As I say, we, you know, it's mainly been at friend an hour or so after a funeral or before a funeral when we've had a chance to sit and converse. So we're having a little bit of a get together at a house there, the Sharon's brother's house, and so Scott sits down and he's sitting there. He's you know, everything's kind of relaxed at this point. He's sipping a beer, and I'm just sitting there just kind of, because a lot of these people I haven't seen in a lot of years, so I'm just kind of sitting and observing. He said, "Chris, how'd you meet Sharon?" And I said, "Well," and I explained that we met in physical therapy school when she was my boss, and she had just started as a professional physical therapist had been there 3 or 4 weeks, and as a newbie in the block in a little rehab center up in Omaha, Nebraska, she was put in charge of guiding intern physical therapists. These are people they're just going out and starting some practice. So I was from down in Dallas, went up to Omaha for 6 weeks internship. So I walked into the office on a cold Monday morning, and there Sharon was. And I said, And I tell her, I knew about 30 minutes after I'd met her. It took me a little longer to address that with her, but we were married about 8 or 9 months later. And my father got the best out of me when we were having rehearsal dinner. He told the story. You see, I was just fixing to go into the Army, and my knees were a little shaking. They were a little shaking then. They're a little shaky right now too, by the way. And I was fixing to go in the Army, but I went on a hunting trip with some buddies of mine, and my dad went with me, and we had to stop at a buddy's supermarket in Fort Worth to buy some groceries. And so the other guys are going around there, and I'd just seen Sharon about a week or so before, but I was kind of antsy, and I hadn't popped the question at all. So I called her. Collect.
That's true.
She honored me, and she accepted the call. Okay. Let's begin here just a little bit. I have a newspaper. It's just a little free newspaper that started being printed 12, 13 years ago in our county. I'm kind of impressed a little bit. There's a man, and y'all can look at this, any of you want to look at it, and maybe get a podcast side. I don't do any of that kind of stuff. But there's a guy named Stephen Stillwell. He teaches he has a little survival kind of deal, and it's called Wichita Bushcraft and Survival. And he teaches about hunting, fishing, living off the land, making your own bows and stuff like that. But he included something that says Christianity and Survival. And I'll just read just a part of it. Imagine what would have happened if Noah didn't have the spiritual discernment to hear from the Lord. None of us would be here today if he wasn't wise and obedient. Building the ark was an act of faith. It wasn't easy, and I guarantee you that undertaking a project of this magnitude was costly and labor-intensive. The Bible tells us that faith without works is dead, and to summarize this, it entails doing something in the physical realm to substantiate it. Actions speak louder than words. So that's kind of something that is very true. There's another page. This is by Jeff Olson, Reflections from Faith and History, The Truman Doctrine. This is really one of the other things that caught my eye in here. The Truman Doctrine, which is 75 years old this week, cannot be, and this man is I think he's probably a teacher. He puts in a weekly article, Reflections from History and Faith. He's a very strong Baptist. The Truman Doctrine cannot be historically or contextually understood, assessed apart from the circumstances in Europe at the end of World War II and the post-war aftermath. During the war conferences, Joseph Stalin had convinced Roosevelt and Churchill that he would allow free elections in the East European countries previously occupied by Nazi forces and those that had been liberated by the Soviet Army in its drive to Berlin. Skipping down, the Truman Doctrine represented a first in American history. Up to that time, our nation, by and large, heeded George Washington's advice that we steer clear of foreign entanglements. How does that set me off? What do you think? Did we pretty well steer clear? Huh? In World War I, did we steer clear from foreign entanglements? How about World War II? No, we were very deep into it. Got so many books here. World War. This by is from Journal of Historical Review. Introduced to that by Sheldon Emery, by the way. Behind the Balfour Declaration, Britain's Great War Pledge to Lord Rothschild. Foreign Office, November 2nd, 1917. This is from James Balfour. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours truly, James Balfour, to Lord Rothschild. That name rings a bell. By the way, there's another little footnote in here. The Zionist Congress of 1911, that was 22 years before Hitler came to power, and 3 years before World War I, a man named Max Nordau said, "How dare the smooth talkers, the clever official babblers, open their mouths and boast of progress? Here they hold jubilant peace conferences in which they talk against war. But the same righteous governments, which are so nobly, industriously active to establish the eternal peace, are preparing by their own confession complete annihilation for 6 million people. And there's nobody except the doomed themselves to raise the voice in protest although this is a worse crime than any war, it's a crime that hadn't happened yet. This is in 1911. You can go all the way back to 1897, and the same picture is sent to us all. So, and obviously, if they were talking about, we were brought into World War I by some influences from the same people. And so this Truman Doctrine doesn't hold effect because, or at least Washington's statement that we ought to steer clear from entanglements. We're so deep into that for so many years. All the history that we hear is just background. Same book. This is in August of 1945. And the war has just ended with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in April, Roosevelt passed, heart attack, whatever, stroke. In May, the war in Europe ended with Berlin falling and Hitler committing suicide. So they had, now we got to get on this British front, this Japanese front. And so we went over, we had Iwo Jima, we had Okinawa, and we had the dropping of the bombs that killed 200,000 people. And then after it's all over, we find out that there's a Chicago Tribune piece of August 19th, 1945. This is 2 weeks before the surrender on the Missouri. And it was two pieces that were put in the Chicago Tribune and the Washington Herald. Is it Herald? Let's see. Anyhow, it says the Japs ask peace in January. This was 8 months prior. Envoys on the way, Tokyo. Okay, so what happened was, and this is the author of the piece that appeared. He was a journalist. He had the newspapers had this information already that Japan had sent an offer to let's end this thing, and this is 4 months before Roosevelt died. Roosevelt was just this was sent by Roosevelt. I'm sorry, this was sent by MacArthur to Roosevelt, and MacArthur gave it to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt gave it a casual reading. He was just about to get ready to go to Yalta for the settlement for a meeting with Churchill and Stalin. And after a casual reading, he said, "MacArthur's our best general, but he's a poor politician," and passed it by. it was like, these people haven't suffered yet enough. So we're going to make them suffer. Mm-hmm. So, and that spot we killed a lot of Japanese. But how many American boys did we lose in Okinawa and Iwo Jima? I saw it was kind of a promotional film. I just happened to pick it up. It was something, it was like Japan in World War II. And it was the ending of, there was a film that was made by the American military. And you know how they're all, you know, I was in the Army, and they, you know, they wanted you, once you look pretty, and I mean, I can't look handsome, but you gotta look like you're really on top of things. And that was what this film was about. It was showing the buildup on Okinawa. And thousands of military airplanes and everything. You know, they'd gone in, they'd killed probably 30,000 American troops, killed and casualties, and an untold number of Japanese just to take the island. So we could build airports and, you know, runways, and they were sending 600 super fortresses. Is that what they call them? I don't remember. But 2,200 gallons of fuel for a 15-mile round trip to Tokyo.
Fifteen hour
trip there and back, going in, bombing the heck out of Tokyo. And the Japanese have already begged to be out of this 4, 5, 6 months later.
Beautiful.
It's amazing the things you can pick up at a dollar sale at the library. Sharon and I were in there the other day, and we picked up a book. It's on the Indianapolis. Okay. Anybody know anything about the Navy ship, the Indianapolis? Anybody remember that at all? Okay. The Indianapolis was... The captain was a man named McVeigh, and he'd been on the ship. It's a 12-year-old battleship, battlecruiser, and he was out between Hawaii and wherever. But he got a message that you need to come here now, and this is really close to the end. Okay, we've already been bombing on all these other places and tearing things up. You need to come, pick up this special package, and you need to take it back a whole lot closer to Japan. I read the book pretty quick and didn't pick up all the names, but. The gist of it is, he traveled the fastest he could. It was like 24.75 knots per hour. I mean, it was beating that ship to death to get it that fast. In fact, the fastest crossing anybody had done. And what he was carrying was the uranium to put in one of these bombs. I mean, that's all it was, just the uranium. And they had a special cadre of folks that were protecting the... And the men on the ship didn't know what they were carrying. They didn't know what was going on. So they took it there, got it offloaded. Now they got to come back. And I don't know, you might remember where the place was.
They went south.
They went south, okay. They had another spot they're supposed to go. And, you know, at this point, you don't have to rush it. You know, we're saving fuel now. And he says, so we want you to travel at 16 miles an hour. But there's been a few sightings of Japanese subs out there. And, but not to worry, I mean, we hadn't seen very much, so we're not really considering a, you know, he checked with the appropriate offices, but we're not expecting any problem, but, you know, you might zigzag a little bit, but kind of use your own judgment is what he was left with. 1,200 men on this cruiser. And so they're heading back. And it's a little bit overcast, but then the moon's coming out. Just clouds, yeah. And the captain, it's 12 o'clock midnight. He's going to go to bed, but, I mean, this guy has, his dad was an admiral, and he was a third-generation Navy man running this boat. He'd been on it for 5 or 6 years. The men loved him. He'd never caused any problem. Never had any problems. And always did what he's supposed to do. And I guess they had, I don't know how active they were in the process, but he made it back. He made it about halfway down, and then there was a it tells the other side of the story, because there's a Japanese submarine that's been floating through some of these waters, and this Japanese man knows that the war's just about over. He says it's, you know, we can't last any longer, but he'd like to do something. And all of a sudden, he comes up and he sees this American ship, and the American ship is now basically heading straight. Okay, none of this zigzag maneuver to, and so he moves in, and it kind of takes you through the thought processes of this man, and you're wondering, how are you going to know the thought process of this Japanese commander? The way you're going to know it is, they brought him in to Washington, D.C. for a court-martial of the captain of the ship that survived. It's the darndest thing. It really is. So, anyhow, 12 midnight, he hits, you know, and by the way, at the court martial, the Japanese captain who has been escorted from Japan to Washington, D.C., and then taken back to Japan. Can you imagine doing that? You know, to get a witness, to try to get a conviction against this guy? And anyhow, the Japanese man said it wouldn't have made a bit of difference. You know, had it dead to right, whether it was zigzagging or not. First shot blew off the bow, the second shot hit it right center, and 300 men were lost when it went down. In 12 minutes, midnight. The captain survived, and the other 900 men, a few of them in boats. But they were in the water 4 days because nobody in the Navy went to look for him. Just one of those glitches, one of those little glitches. We just, we got a boat out there with, before we hadn't heard from them, but they were supposed to have come in. So obviously they would have come in. And it's just the thing, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. And they, I think they had maybe 300 men that survived 400 or 4 days in the water. A lot of them, eaten by shark, a lot of them. And finally, it was only by God's good grace. There was a pilot out flying over the same water, and he had to go to the, he had to go to the back of his plane. The other crew member, somebody, probably a co-pilot, but they're kind of controlling right now. He walks back there. There's someone else in there. This is 4 days later, and so there's some heads popping around, and these men are stretched out for miles, whatever's left on them. And so they brought them back in, and then 3 or 4 months later, this man's career basically in the Navy. He's just got a stigma now. He'll never get rid of, because the Navy, Navy couldn't say, we screwed up. And sometime I don't feel too patriotic. And I tell that because there was a time, I was an Eagle Scout. I did that whole thing, I tried to, and then went to college. Kind of worked my way through, and finally taught for a year. Man, I couldn't hang on real good teaching. Taught high school, and some chemistry and some junior high stuff. Science, but then I did get accepted to physical therapy school. So that's what I kind of really wanted to do. But during that time frame of teaching, this would have been in 67, 68. I lived in Dallas. There was a high school called South Oak Cliff. I was assigned to do a student teaching series for 6 weeks. And so I went over to this school. I was going to North Texas State University, where I was finishing up my degree. I graduated in August, but had to do the student teaching the last 6 weeks of the year. So turns out my counselor at the college, he'd kind of dropped the ball and didn't get in touch with the people at South Oak Cliff High School to tell them that they got a student teacher coming over there that's going to show up. So I show up first thing and dressed in a nice suit and ready to kill the tiger and meet my first day of teaching. And the first thing I did, I walked in. And I better tell you about South Oak Cliff. I lived in Oak Cliff, and that's where I grew up. But there was there'd been a little change in stuff. Now this is like 67 or so, 67, 68, can't recall exactly the numbers. But that particular high school had gone from 75% of one particular kind of people, and about 25% of another kind of people. In 1 year period, it went from, those numbers were switched. Mm-hmm. And I walked in, where, you know, ready to go to the office. It's 9:30 o'clock, just right on time. And this little kid runs up to me, and he said, Mister, there's a fire in the boys' bathroom. I hadn't even gone to the office yet. And so I go down there. Somebody's lit a cigarette or whatever, and thrown it in the, and so I had to round up somebody to kill you because the trash can's burning in here. excitement of public schools. So I taught a year, and
but not there.
But not there. I got in. No. And that school. Yeah, it's funny. In the middle of the day, or at the end of the day, the science teacher, the chemistry teacher I was teaching with, just a great guy. But he came and he says, Chris, I love doing student teaching. I enjoy it so much, or having student teachers, because, you know, it's exciting. And he says, but I'm calling your, you know, I'm calling your manager or your counselor. He says, you don't belong. So anyhow, the next year I taught at MacArthur High School over in Irving. You know, it was a pretty high class neighborhood, but they still had a lot of beginning mixture, and I was getting, even in that setting, I found, probably in my home grade class, probably 40 to 50% of the children were not living in what we call a nuclear home, where their, you know, mother and father and other children they're all coming from split marriages. And this is in the '60s. Almost everything's kind of You grow up thinking things are one way, and then it almost felt like things just changed so much in those years. And but I made it through and met Sharon. Well, that's a bunch of just some background thoughts, but I don't know what all I was going to say today. Ted had made a comment about this conspiracy in Philadelphia. He'd said something about it, and I said, that's kind of sound like a pretty interesting book. So he told me where to, I think he had one. I think he sold me this one, as I recall. And then he told me that they weren't available, and he had sold his own. Do you have one of these? I'll leave it with you. Okay, it's yours. Thank you. The back cover is pretty instructive. And when I went into the military, this is the act that got me into the military, but it certainly got me away from the draft card, so that was okay at that time. But I had to go, and I had to swear in, and take an oath to the Constitution to do that. I was a Boy Scout. I had no problem with the Constitution. I had no problem. I'm gung ho. I'm ready for this. And went to there was a retired Army officer and over at working at the big military complex, and he says, "Yeah, I can swear you in." So he swore me in. It's all done. Okay. Now, 30 years later, or more, 40 years later, we kind of began hearing the rest of the story. On May 25th, 1787, a group of 55 men gathered for a closed meeting in Philadelphia. Officially, it was being convened to discuss alterations to the Constitution of the United States of America, the Articles of Confederation. So that was the original Constitution of the States of America, was the Articles of Confederation. Some state legislatures had authorized their representatives to attend the meeting only on this basis, explicitly prohibiting them from considering a new constitution. That's right out of the box. As soon as the meeting opened, the outline of a new constitution was submitted to the group by the Virginians. The three more plans were submitted within days for a new constitution. There was no discussion at any time of a revision of the articles. That's the only thing they had permission to do. The articles would be replaced. To make certain that the general public did not find out about the nature of this conspiracy, the convention members swore an oath not to discuss any proceedings with the public for the rest of their lives. None of Madison's notes, which are included in another book I have. This is put out by, this is a facsimile copy of a document illustrative of the formation of the North American states. Anyhow, that's Madison's notes, and they didn't come out, 1836, I think, is when it was. You know, after everybody, after all these guys had passed down the road. The convention members swore an oath not to discuss any proceedings with the public for the rest of their lives. Only firsthand accounts of the proceedings were published several years later after the deaths of the last survivor, James Madison, in 1836. The press was forbidden to attend. The meetings were held on the second floor of the building so that would-be eavesdroppers could not hear anything. For nearly 4 months, the delegates debated. At the end of the convention on September 17th, the 39 delegates who had not rebelled again agreed to submit the new, clearly illegal document to a vote, not to the legislatures that had authorized the convention, but by a series of state conventions in which the legislatures would play no official role. So we're just scrapping what the articles told us we're supposed to be doing, and we're inventing something new. The new constitution would become the law of the land whenever the nine states' conventions ratified it. This was an explicit violation of the articles, which required a unanimous vote for amendments. Thus did a group of men launch a coup d'etat. This coup established a new national covenant in 1788, a covenant stripped of the articles, invocation of God, the great governor of the world, with only the old country's name transferred for public relations sake, the United States of America. Today, we would call this a trademark violation, but it worked. This is a story of the deeply theological origins and implications of that coup. I've read this portion of it. Anybody remember the Shays Rebellion? Mm-hmm. Ever hear discussed or anything? Maybe I'd heard a little bit in 11th year, in 11th grade or something like that in the history class. But you just saw it as a bunch of rabble risers that somebody had to go put down and keep them from ruining this beautiful government we got. Anyhow, this is in, it's about a 15, I'm just gonna kind of give you some highlights here. Remember John Hancock? Okay, the signature on the document great big signature. You put your John Hancock here, it says. He was actually the governor of Massachusetts. And this was in, the Shays Rebellion took place in like winter 1776 or 1786, right before the Constitution was, right before the Constitutional Convention took place. And there were some problems because there were correctable problems. Most of it you can kind of translate to one word, is that, you know, we've been fighting this Revolutionary War, and we've been paying, the states have been paying their soldiers in chips of paper, and take these for doing your work. Well, they started doing that. It was unbacked. The scripture calls, I think it's about 185 times the word money is used, and it always refers to something, okay? Most often silver, kesa. But we already knew we had some experience here already with a lot of these 13 colonies, just printing paper. So that's what they did, and they were paying their guys in paper, and it would just immediately drop to 50 or 20, and eventually it got down to 1%. You couldn't even give the stuff away. And that's what was happening. And so a lot of people were kind of losing faith. This is after the war's already been won. And if you look on page 33, this is this little document again. It was printed originally by the House of Representatives back in 1926, and it was passed out. They'd give so many copies to each state, and this is this is just kind of a facsimile copy of that. But on page 33, they were going to try. It says, "This is an article." Confederation, the United States, small u, in Congress assembled, shall never engage in a war, nor grant letters of marque and reprisal in time of peace, nor enter into any treaties or alliances, nor coin money, nor regulate the value thereof, nor ascertain the sums and expenses necessary for the pretenses for the defense and welfare of the United States, or any of them, nor emit bills of credit, nor borrow money on the credit of the United States. Okay. So the states were carrying a lot of paper here, and they got to figure out how to handle it because it's causing a lot of headache in the government. And in regard to the Shays Rebellion, George Washington writes this letter, a letter which I have just received from General Knox, who had just returned from Massachusetts. Whether he had been sent by Congress consequent of the commotion in that state, the Shays Rebellion, it's replete with melancholy information of the temper and the design of a considerable part of that people. They're all getting mad over here in Massachusetts. And he said, among other things, this is why they're getting mad. Their creed is that the property of the United States has been protected from confiscation by Britain by the joint exertions of all, and therefore ought to be the common property of all. And he that attempts opposition to this creed is an enemy to equity and justice, and ought to be swept off the face of the earth. Go. You've got 92,000 men that were in the state militia of Massachusetts. And these are just, they ought to be in Washington, in this letter, this is George Washington writing. That was Knox's remark. And Washington says, "How melancholy is the reflection that in so short a space we should have made such large strides towards fulfilling the prediction of our transatlantic foe. Leave them to themselves and their government will soon dissolve." And he ends the paragraph saying, "The 13 sovereignties pulling against each other and all tugging at the federal head will soon bring ruin on the whole, whereas a liberal and energetic constitution, well guarded and closely watched to prevent encroachments, might restore us to that degree of respectability and consequence to which we had a fair claim and the brightest prospect of returning." So he was saying, well, we need to adjust this thing. So, I mean, where people aren't feeling this way. I mean, we got this revelation going on here. Well, Washington was told by two trusted, I'm going to just read what I've got in mind. Washington was told by two trusted informants in Massachusetts that this was a widespread revolt of the lower classes. These rebels were undermining public order in their quest to overturn property rights. You see, Boston, more toward the east, and all these guys are out on the western counties. And all these guys, I mean, they know how to cut firewood, and they know how to shoe a horse, and they know how to do a lot of the yeoman tasks that a lot of us hopefully are learning ourselves to kind of take care of our own needs and stuff like that. They didn't, you know, but the people that were hacked off about this Shays Rebellion were the folks over here in Boston. Because these guys over in Boston were the ones, and by the way, there'd been a change of the governorship here. And this is the whole thing turns on the fact that our Constitution probably Washington would not have gone to the Constitutional Convention unless something like Shays had happened. And the reason it happened was that John Hancock, he was wealthy, but if he had a poor guy that owed him something, he'd settle up in script with that guy. But for the rich guys, he wanted to get paid in silver. But so all these folks, and he was not enforcing the taxation laws, the property tax, that hit hardest at these folks in the West, because they're getting, it's a poll tax. So you got a 16-year-old boy or 15-year-old boy that doesn't know a whole lot right yet, and he's getting charged at the same rate as, you know, a grown man. And so property tax, these folks could have made it out here, except now we've got this heavy tax. And the reason, I mean, it worked just fine for a number of years until John Hancock developed GACT. And so in 1786, he said, "I'm not going to run for Congress." So another man who was one of the Boston elite in crowd that actually happened to own about 3,200 pounds of that was due to him because he had bought up all this, you know, He's got 35% of this script had been bought up by 40 men, or it's the other way around, 40, 30, or 5. But the majority of this money that needs to be paid back, bought by a bunch of merchants over here on the eastern side. And these guys over here in the western part of the state, they're not really anxious of supporting all that, especially since they arranged it that the interest on this money due was to be paid in silver. So they had Shays Rebellion. It wasn't, Daniel Shays was found to be, he was in the war, and he was he'd been in the War of Independence, been given a sword by Lafayette. He's a good guy. And it's not a bunch of poor guys. They could make it. They weren't just a bunch of rabble. It was men that really had a feeling that, this is not exactly right. So they had Shays Rebellion. Most in high school, it's taught basically that, it's just a bunch of rabble that, they're just broke deadbeats, and so we had to send in the crew to take care of them. Well, it turns out that the history of Shays Rebellion was turned on its head back, I think, in 1981, something like that. I got the book on interlibrary loan and read it one time, and it's that all these people came from these western counties, but they had big families, and so it was really hitting them really hard when all their sons had a poll tax fee to pay, and
in silver,
to take care of these guys when they're trying to carve something out of the wilderness, and a professor, Shays Rebellion has been talked about for a lot of years, and this professor named Williams had at the University of Massachusetts found out, hey, we've got some records on this, and they looked and they had actually all in the inhabitants from where they were and what they owned and that sort of thing. These were not deadbeats. These were some decent patriotic men that really had a belief that, we ought to treat this a little bit different. These guys have many of them died fighting that thing, and it shouldn't just go to this little group over here in Boston. And that's what it whole was. But then that was the key that this General Knox and later General Lincoln kicked in and said, oh, we've got to clean this whole mess up. George Washington, I know you want to sit over there on Mount Vernon and rest and prune your apple trees and stuff, but we can't have that. Only way we're going to pass this Constitution, only way we're going to get this through, you'll join us, and it's in next May, George. Can you make it? And it's North gives a really interesting way of putting this. Okay, let's see. Okay. Knox. Knox is just hint said, but we find we're men, actual men, possessing all the turbulent passions belonging to that animal, and that we must have a government, proper and adequate form, a constitution, which was to come becoming ahead. Knox, and this is what Norris says, Knox was writing a direct response sales letter. You ever get one of those in the mail? How many a week do you get? Which turned out to be the second most influential sales letter in American history, second only to Washington's letter to Congress on September 17th, 1787. Every direct response letter needs a powerful close, which is called the Act Now offer. Knox called on Washington to join with the besieged men of property in Massachusetts, speculators on the government bonds, to turn back these rural communists of the lower sort. The nationalists are ready to defend the true interests of society. What about you, George? Will you wimp out on this crucial juncture? Knox was a master of the close. A little bit. And so Washington wrote him back, I feel, my dear General Knox, infinitely more than I can express to you for the disorders which have arisen in these states. Notwithstanding the boasted value of virtue of America, we are far gone in everything noble and bad. In this, as in most other matters, we're too slow. When this spirit first dawned, probably it might easily have been checked, but scarcely within reach of human kin at this moment to say when, where, or how it will end. There are combustibles in every state which a spark may set fire to. By late act, it seems very desirous of a general convention to revise and amend the federal constitution. What are the prevailing sentiments of the one now proposed to be held at Philadelphia? I'd like to know. How will it be attended? You are the fountain of intelligence, Mr. Knox. And where the wisdom of the nation is to be presumed has concentrated, consequently better able, as I have had abundant experience of your intelligence, confidence, and candor to solve the problems. The commotions of Massachusetts have wrought prodigious changes in the minds of men in that state respecting the power of governments. Everybody said that must be strengthened. The rebellion in Massachusetts was what forced Washington's hand. He decided to support Madison's plan for the meeting in Philadelphia of leading politicians, who would then create a new form of civil government, therefore placing the Articles of Confederation, replacing the Articles of Confederation. He decided to attend the convention, contrary to his previous statements. His presence at the convention and his promotional letter to Congress that accompanied the proposed constitution were crucial to Congress that accompanied the proposed constitution were crucial to the success of the nationalist plans to overturn the existing national government. Thus the fate of the proposed United States Congress has turned on John Hancock's big toe. That's where you get gout. But even with that, we had a little protection that some of these men were trying to lay for us. This is in April. Oh, This is in April, I think. April or August? August. They've been here 4 months in this building. Trying to settle up and figure out how to put this all together. And they're having a vote on. That's kind of, I'm sorry, hang on just a second, guys. 56. Okay, here it is, yeah. Okay, there it is. Remember that first thing I read to you about omit in there, back on page 36, I think it was. Now we're up a little further. This is August, whatever, August 17th, I think. Okay. Governor, how is that pronounced? You know, Ted? Governor, you know what I'm talking about? This is supposedly, if you read, you know, if you were to have read the book by Gary Fraser, Reason, whatever, you know, the doc from out in California who wrote, I forgot what his name was, Gary Fraser, I think, Reason, Revolution, and Theocratic Rationalism, something like that. Anyhow, he gives a bio on. He gives a bio on Governor Morris. Governor Morris moved to strike out emit bills of credit on the United States. So we're going to take this word out because we don't need it. He said if the United States had credit, such bills would be unnecessary. If they had not, they would be unjust and useless. Governor Morris was really a rounder. He had gone and he'd been over, he'd done a lot of rowdy things over him. And this is a guy that actually put the pen to paper. And so if you read the votes that they have on this day to take out any possibility, you'll see you count paper money 12 times, I think, 12 times. They were all afraid of this paper money machine. And that's why you have no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. That vote was 9-11. Okay. So now if we have, what happens if the state of Arkansas, this is what, one thing I asked my local judge. Sharon got a notice for jury duty the other day. I answered it for her and told this judge, and I visited with him a lot, so he kind of knows I'm a little strange. And I said, you can't even define what a state is. We talk about the state of Missouri. How can you define a state that takes checks and credit cards? It says right there, you can't do it. Well, there's too much more. So. Oh, one thing, real quick. Another thing in this pulse, right here, we're kind of a town of notoriety. This is the Eclipse Town Hall meeting. It shows a big picture of the eclipse coming up 2 years from now. And so they're trying to, on April 8th, 2024, nearly two-thirds of Arkansas will be within the path of totality of the great American total solar eclipse. It's like an American fucking deal. Anyhow, the event will bring thousands of visitors to the natural state to experience the phenomenon. Mina will experience 4 minutes of pure solar darkness. One of the greater links in Arkansas. and will be a major tourism draw for the community. To help the community prepare, the city of Mena is hosting a town hall meeting on April 6th. Y'all can come. The meeting will be held at the Wichita Center on the campus of the University of Arkansas, Rich Mountain. Purpose is to figure out how we're going to bring as many bucks as we can into our county. I don't know if it's true. I don't know if it has any significance. But you know, it's going to go. I don't know if it's going to go this way or this way. I asked Matthew a while ago if he remembered or could look up when the date was. Well, 3 years ago, I saw something by Pete Peters, son-in-law, I believe, publication that he put out, and it was referring to this eventual thing's come. It's kind of, you know, the one went this way, and now we're going to have one going this way or the other way. But they hit right about pretty close up to the Nuremberg Fault. I thought that was kind of funny. And if you kind of compute the dates, and I did, it's 6 years, 6 months, 6 weeks, and 6 days apart. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Harold. A lot of preparation into that. We appreciate that. All right. It's about 11:15. We'll take about 15 minutes, and we'll come back at 11:30 for Ted. And Teresa, what time are they coming? 12:30. Okay, and lunch will be sometime shortly after 12:30. All right, we'll be back in about 15 minutes.